Good afternoon. Education Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome, everybody. Great to see you all back. I was telling someone, it feels like a first day of school, and I guess that's appropriate for the Education Finance Committee, so. And glad to see great attendance, and I'm sorry we're starting a little bit late today. I will try to start on time and keep us on time and that. We have a number of new faces on the committee amongst the members, but we also have some new faces among our nonpartisan staff and also our committee administrators, new for anybody who was on the committee last session. So what I'd like to do is start off with introductions, and then we'll talk about some things in your packet. And mostly what we're going to be doing today and tomorrow is having presentations by our nonpartisan staff to just kind of acquaint everyone with education finance in Minnesota, a lot of the charts and information that we use on this committee, so everyone is familiar. And so for members who have been on this committee for a number of years and know it will be kind of old hat in review, but obviously everyone is free to ask questions and clarifications on things. I just want to make sure we're all starting from a good base of knowledge on how education and our schools are funded in Minnesota. And then questions you may have about that before we get into the meat of further hearings down the road. So with that, glad to see everyone. I'll start by way of introduction. My name is Jennifer Loon, and I represent Eden Prairie, Minnesota. I have most of the city of Eden Prairie in my district, 48B. This is my fifth term in the Minnesota House, so starting that. And I've been on education finance for most of the time that I've served here, except for 2 years back a few years ago when I had switched to some other committees. But it's been a really rewarding experience. I love serving on this committee. I don't have any particular background in education. I'm not a former teacher or school board member, but was a very active parent of my two daughters who both went through public schools in Eden Prairie. And served on PTO board and several other school district-wide boards in that capacity. So maybe just an overly interested parent volunteer. So with that, I think I will go ahead and start. Representative Erickson, do you want to start and introduce yourself? And I'm going to ask everyone, just so we get to know each other a little better, if you want to share, I'll give you your choice, either a favorite memory or something you'd like to share about your own education, or if you'd like to share sort of a priority or one issue that would be really important to you as we look at the education of students in Minnesota and our work here on this committee for the next 2 years. So I'll give you your option. So.
I'm Representative Sandra Erickson. I represent District 15A, which is East Central Minnesota, Mille Lacs, Kennebec, and Sherburne counties. I am the chair of the Policy Committee here in the House. I think I've been on this Education Finance Committee for about 15, 16 years. My favorite memory from elementary school is I set a goal in third grade to get 100% on every single test in English. And I did.
So if we have any grammar questions, they were going to be directed to Representative Erickson. Thank you.
I'm Representative Peggy Scott. I represent Andover, Northern Coon Rapids, and one precinct in the city of Ramsey. This is my fifth term, starting my fifth term, and I guess my priority would be closing that achievement gap. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Tony Juergens. I represent District 54B. Which is about half of Cottage Grove, all of Hastings, Afton, Denmark Township, and Ninninger Township. And this is my first term, and I guess I'll steal Representative Scott's closing the achievement gap or keeping an eye on that would be my number one priority here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Dario Anselmo. I represent District 49A, which is largely the city of Edina. We have Edina School District and a little bit of Hopkins School District. As part of that, my background is small business, but I've spent a lot of time around educational issues. I've got three kids. They're in the Edina Public Schools. So we've seen a lot of the different facets and flavors as these schools have changed a lot in our community. My favorite memory probably from school was being able to take a class called Current Events. And I thought that was wonderful that you could do well in a class in school just by reading lots of newspapers. So that was hopeful, and I plan to do a lot of studying in this committee here. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. My name is John Poston. I represent District 9A, which is in north central Minnesota, southern Cass County, a part of Todd County, and part of Wadena County. My favorite memory from school is winning the Iowa Football State Championship in 1974.
Very good. Excellent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Roz Peterson, and I represent House District 56B, which is Burnsville, Lakeville area. And prior to this, I served on school board for 8 years, and I also served on the MSBA board and the Minnesota State High School League board. And I have lots of priorities for education, but one I'd like to highlight is innovation and teacher-empowered school grants.
We'll come back and go to staff after we finish with the member introduction. So, Representative Slocum, do you want to start? We'll go inside the table and around.
I'm Linda Slocum. I represent Richfield and Parkwell, half of Richfield, and about a third of Bloomington. And what are we supposed to answer?
Either your choice of either a favorite memory from your days in school or a priority. Can I choose for you?
I was kind of a naughty pants. I said, but you know, every time I was naughty, I got busted. So, you know, I would say my favorite memory was hiding in the bathroom from the teachers. And, you know, I got in trouble at school, and then because it was a different time, I got in more trouble at home. My parents would get very mad.
Great memory.
And I couldn't leave the yard, and I couldn't leave the house. Yeah. Anyway, I guess my goal would be to individualize for the naughty pantses so that they can do their education kind of their way, so kids can do theirs their way.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Paul Marquardt. Represent District 4B, which is all or parts of Clay, Norman, and Becker County. This is my ninth term. I currently still teach social studies at Dilworth Glendon Felton. I think this was my 33rd year, which I truly enjoy. And I guess for priorities is closing the achievement gap, but also trying to make sure we keep property taxes down and equity throughout the state.
Thank you. Representative Tice.
My name is Tiama Tice. I represent 14A, which is St. Cloud, the north and southwest part of St. Cloud, Way Park and St. Augusta. And a favorite memory would be that I went to a Catholic grade school, but then for high school I went to Eden Valley Watkins, and we were the first year of volleyball, that we had women's volleyball. So when people talk about Title IX, it wasn't that far away from what I didn't realize we were so groundbreaking. And I also met my husband there in the ladies' bathroom at the football game.
All right, you may be asked offline about that, but never mind. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dennis Smith, representing Maple Grove and Osseo, and a goal for the committee for myself is innovation.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Nornes.
Oh. Well, I'm Bud Nornes. I'm in my 11th term, and I represent half of Otter Tail County. So for a rural district, I've got a small district because of the population where I come from. And I consider that to be I'm very fortunate because I don't have that many miles to travel. As far as memories go, I have a lot of them, but can I do two things? Can I also say one of the things as a goal, I've talked to superintendents and educators, they would like us not to do any more burdensome things to them. So if we can help lessen their load a little bit while not doing any harm, that's a goal. My favorite memory, I decided early that I'd like to go into communications. Well, while I was in high school, somehow they designated me as the school news reporter. So every Wednesday, I would go down to the basement of the mayor's house and broadcast live on the radio station in Crookston, Minnesota. So every week, I was there live on the radio, and I don't know if it helped me or not, but I did spend a few years doing that later, so appreciated that. That's it.
Very good. Very good. Representative Murphy.
I'm Mary Murphy. I represent South St. Louis County and Lake Counties and school districts 704, 700, 709, and 381. And part of a little tiny part of St. Louis County rural schools. I taught for 36 years, 3 years in the area that's now part of 381, but it was part of the St. Louis County schools when I first started. And now it's fun to go there on the first Wednesday of the month because I'm a member of their homesteaders group, and it's the senior citizen group for that area, and the kids that were in my first class for the first 3 years of my teaching career are now senior homesteaders too. So it's so much fun, and I represent them at the legislature, and that never happened before. But I was at for 33 years at Duluth Central High School, which is no longer either. My goal is to continue appropriating money to full-service community schools across the state, especially to the areas that don't have full services that want to begin.
Very good. Thank you. We're very pleased to have you back with us. Representative Thiessen, welcome.
Thank you. Paul Thiessen, Minneapolis. And my seventh term, although my first, I've never served on an education committee before, so we'll see how that goes.
Yes, we will.
And and I guess my priority is probably early childhood education stuff.
Excellent. Great. Well, we're glad to have you. Representative Moran.
Happy New Year's, everybody, and welcome back. My name is Rena Moran. I represent District 65A here in St. Paul. So my district is right outside of this building, west of the avenue. I am going into my fourth term, and I think some of my memories of early years and probably like elementary school was being connected to teachers who was really a part of the community and how they really invested in every child. And I just, I could just name some of my first grade teacher, my fourth grade teacher, and sixth, because they just had an impact on my life. But my priorities would be that as we look at how we fund education, that we are innovative and we are creative, and we do allow some local control in what that looks like.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome, Representative Sansi.
I'm Julie Sanstead. I'm from 6A, Northeast Minnesota. I'm out of Hibbing. I'm a teacher currently, and I'm going to share both a memory and my goals. My favorite memory, I think, from school was being able to perform the halftime show in Sweden when the Vikings and the Chicago Bears played. Our high school band was able to perform, and that was really a fantastic opportunity. As far as goals, for me, it's going to be bringing the real help into the classrooms to meet all of Minnesota students where they're at, and then give them the proper helps that they need so all students can succeed, and in doing so, hopefully closing the achievement gap and lightening the load on our teachers, too.
Thank you. Welcome. We're very glad to have you with us. And a special welcome to our DFLE, Representative Dabney.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Kind of you. Jim Dabney, I represent part of South Minneapolis. I'm entering my ninth term in the House. I taught middle school social studies for 17 years. I've got two children thriving in the Minneapolis public schools, a junior and an eighth grader. And I am in my sixth year as a volunteer in the Minneapolis schools, coaching Lego robotics. We've got our tournament on Saturday. big push this week. We'll see how it goes, but that does go to my priorities about seeing if we can't allow teachers to make education more relevant for students and therefore engaging, and then also respecting the and possibly prioritizing the place of out-of-school time opportunities for engaging kids and keeping them inside the fences where we want them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Look forward to working with you. Representative Mariani, very good to see you.
Good to see you, Madam Chair. Carlos Mariani, welcome to my district. The capital sits in my district. I obviously represent St. Paul, or a good chunk of St. Paul. We think of ourselves in St. Paul a little bit as sort of the Ellis Island of Minnesota. A number of our racial ethnic communities going back to Eastern Europeans, Jewish community, Mexican communities, got their start, if you will, in our state, in and around the river, on both banks of the river here. I'm in my 13th term, and I would say, as a member of Representative Erickson's committee, I talked about the diversity of teachers as my big goal and desire for that committee. For this committee, I would say, in addition to that, doing whatever we can to provide, since this is a resource committee, good resources to support students. There are obviously a lot of big mental health and illness issues that continue to pop up in our schools, and our students themselves are bringing up those issues, our teachers, educators, et cetera. There's so much we can do to provide support for students with that. And in other areas, I hope, I look forward to working with you, Madam Chair, to see what we can do to provide some needed additional state resources that really have these students' backs. So thank you. Looking forward to working with you.
Likewise, thank you so much. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my name is Anna Wills. I'm the state representative from Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Coates. It's District 57B, starting my third term, and I've been on education finance the whole way, and have enjoyed my time. I bring an interesting perspective to the committee as the first homeschool graduate in the Minnesota legislature, in modern history anyway. And because of that, I have a deep interest in school choice and making sure that we have viable options for families, whether it's private, public, or homeschooling, making sure all of those are accessible and the best options available to families throughout the state. And I also was a personal care attendant for my younger brother, who has high functioning autism, and so I have a special interest in special education and finding ways to help those kids who just need a little extra boost, and especially the teachers who work with those students and reducing the burden on them. I've been trying to deal with reducing the paperwork load and helping them be able to focus on the students and help them succeed. So those are some of my areas of interest, and honored to be on the committee again.
All right. Thank you so much. And before we go to you, Representative Kreisha, if anyone's cell phone is anywhere near the microphones, it will create a interference with the microphone system. And so if we're hearing buzzing, that's probably what it is. So you can stick them down below or turn it off if it's a problem. That would be helpful. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome, committee members. Ron Kreisha, I serve in 9B. My centrally located town in Morrison County is Little Falls, parts of Todd County as well. Former educator, as well as business person, have worked through the ranks of education. My goal primarily is the young people, the younger students, the vulnerable and disadvantaged. But I have to share, as I was thinking about this, one of my favorite memories of teaching. And Representative Dabney mentioned being engaging, and I know Representative Flokin and I have talked about the middle school students. Certainly a great fondness in my heart for middle school students, so I'll share a quick story with you. When I was just a young lad teaching in eighth grade students, and I was teaching diagramming of sentences, and you know how incredibly invigorating that can be. Just really, yeah, absolutely, Representative Erickson, you know. But I liked it as well, and I was always very overly enthusiastic because you have to engage these young learners. And again, a young lad, you know, just a little green. And I remember teaching the eighth grade classroom third period in Ivanhoe, Minnesota, and I was explaining to them diagramming of sentences and doing it on the board and telling them about how incredibly uplifting this could be and how much fun it could be. And I told them, I said, you know, this was something that I was so excited about that even my wife and I did on the weekends. This is how we pass the time. And did I mention I was a young lad, green behind the ears? And one of the students, his name was Brett, raised his hand and said, Mr. Kreisha, is that what your generation calls it now?
An education for all of you. All of us. All right. And Representative Bennett, who is our vice chair for the committee this year, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to be back on this committee. I'm Peggy Bennett. I represent District 27A. This is my second term. 27A, the largest city is Albert Lea, and we kind of spread out in that central area of southern Minnesota. I taught for 33 years in Albert Lea Elementary School, mostly first grade. Loved it very much, and I retired about a year and a half ago. And I will share one of my favorite memories, but it's kind of a dual memory I'll need to share. I can clearly remember when I was in grade school. I hated school at that time. I was sitting in my climbing tree, and I just remember thinking, I will never be a teacher. And so I became a teacher, and I loved it. And one of my goals was always to help kids get excited about learning and like to be there. But I also remember as a young adult saying I would never get involved in politics. And so I've learned never to say never, and I do actually enjoy what I'm doing now as well. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Very, very pleased to have you. So now I would like the staff to introduce themselves as well. We have some familiar faces for those of you who have been on the committee and some new faces as well. So go ahead and start with you, Ms. Kynes.
My name is Doreen Kynes. This is the second time around for me with Education Finance. Mm-hmm.
And also the keeper of my schedule. So be very kind to Doreen. So, Harry?
Oh, excuse me. Hi, Harry Kennedy. Entering my 11th year here between serving 4 years with Governor Pawlenty and entering my 7th year here at the House. Very excited about the new adventure working with everybody here on the Education Finance Committee. I'm a former PTO president for Rush Creek Elementary School in Maple Grove, and my favorite memory is probably it involves a lot of memories, but having two parents that were very involved and concerned with their children's education. And that involves a lot of memories, but there's one I was just thinking about the other day, helping my son recently with his diorama for the Jamestown Colony. And remember when I was growing up, the popsicle sticks weren't really working on my log cabin, and it was a complete disaster, but having the calm influence of my mother, who was a middle school teacher for 6 years, really helped out, and at least we got the diorama done. But very very pleased to be here and look forward to working with everybody.
Thank you. Tim?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tim Strom from House Research, and I'm very glad to be back again this year. So I'm looking forward to another couple of fun years here in the education finance world.
We look forward to you continuing to share your wisdom with us. We appreciate it. Amy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim is still adjusting to being on the other side of the table,
that's right.
So we're going to have to give him a couple days. I'm Amy Roberts. I'm the new GOP researcher for the House Education and Education Finance Committees. New to research, but not new to the House. I was a committee administrator for one of the crime committees a long time ago. Representative Murphy was on that committee way back then. I also worked as a prosecutor in Dakota County and the Department of Education as the Director of Compliance. I learned early on, I was a good student, but I probably didn't make too many favorite lists. I had a tendency to question whether or not certain classroom rules were necessary or if they should be applied uniformly or if perhaps there were circumstances or times and situations where maybe we needed to make adjustments. And I had a tendency to ask a lot of questions. I was told very early on that I was destined to be an attorney. And while I fought it for a while, I nonetheless went to Syracuse Law School.
Sounds like the legislature may be a good place for you, too.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Emily Adrians, and I'm the new fiscal analyst for the committee. I was a fiscal analyst from 2006 to the beginning of 2014 as well. So I'm not new to the house, but I am new to education. So I have three kids, so education is near and dear to my heart. And I am learning, but if I don't know the answer to questions, I know that Tim will. So.
Excellent. And Mars?
Thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Mars Beltrandi E. Rudquist. This is my first session with the Education Committees with the House DFL Research Department. But 2 years ago, or three sessions ago, I think, I was a House page here, and I've also been a legislative assistant.
Welcome. Glad to have you here. And our two committee pages, we have Ryan Nash and Emma Weese. Am I pronouncing your name right, Emma?
Yeah.
Okay. So why don't you each tell us just a little bit about yourself and welcome. Our pages are so important to helping us function as a committee, and we're really, really glad that you're here.
Madam Chair, my name is Ryan Nash, and this is my third year as a page. So it's good to be back.
Good. Glad to have you back. Thank you. Emma?
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Emma Weese, and this is my first year as a page, and I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you very much. All right. And also with us sitting probably close by in the audience, we have Kevin Baer, who is our person in the revisor's office. There's Kevin. Thanks for being here. And also who may be here from time to time is Christina Parra. I don't know if any of you have met Christina, but she, folks who have been working in education may know that Lisa Larson retired after many years of service to the House as our nonpartisan policy expert. And so Christina is the new person in that position. And so I know she'll do great work for us as well. So welcome to everyone, and thank you all for grand introduction. I realize I didn't share anything in particular with you, and the chair has a lot of priorities and things to keep track of. So I'll just say that, you know, providing adequate resources, which is the goal of the Finances Committee, is providing resources, but to make sure that our schools can do the best that they can for every student in Minnesota, reaching every student and having each of them educated to their fullest potential would be my overall goal, and that encompasses closing the achievement gap. Innovation has been mentioned, you know, finding innovative ways to make sure that we can individualize education, reaching kids where they are and helping them to grow and be excited about their learning would be an overall goal for me. Hard to narrow down a memory from school. I liked school for the most part as a student, but different things stick with you. I'll share a story my mother always used to tell. I'm not tall, and that was never the case. So I was always at the tiny end of the class height rank. So I think it was first grade. I was sitting in first grade, and I was so curious as to what my classmates were doing that I got up onto my desk and stood on my desk to have a good look around, just because I needed to know what everyone was doing. And so I guess curious always about the goings-on in the classroom and that. So we probably didn't do that more than once, and it was brought to my parents' attention. But anyway, it worked that day. So for the rest of our time today and probably spilling over into tomorrow, we're going to have Ms. Adrians and Mr. Strom be doing presentations to us, going over some charts as well as a PowerPoint presentation, which we may not get to until tomorrow. But I would also mention that the committee rules are in your folders. I don't think any surprises there. Just one thing I would note, some committees do it differently, but we do have a 24-hour rule requirement for filing of amendments and that when we are marking up bills. And I would just say for general purposes, you know, I like to run a very collegial committee. If you have a bill you'd like to have heard, you know, just make sure to let us know. We're happy to hear as many as we can work in to our committee schedule. If you have an idea or an amendment or something you'd like to change, you know, come and talk to me. I like to work things out as best we can. I am open to ideas, all good ideas, from wherever they may come from, and do look forward to working with all of you. We're in the process of trying to set up meetings with each of you individually, kind of starting with not only our DFL lead, but also brand new members to the committee and brand new members to the legislature who are serving on the committee. So your LAs will be getting a call from Ms. Kynes to set that up. And just want to get a chance to talk to you all individually about maybe ideas on legislation you'd like to introduce, or just if there's a priority issue from your own area, your districts, your school districts that you'd like to share with me, so I'm aware. That would be a great time to share it with me. So anyway, and I look forward to working with all of you. So with that, any questions before we move into the presentations by nonpartisan staff?
Madam Chair, we'll move to the witness stand. That
okay.
Be a little easier for you to make.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. All right. And I should mention also, while Ms. Adrians and Mr. Strom are moving to the witness table, that we'll have these overview today and Wednesday, and then Thursday we will have the Commissioner Caselius will be with us, and I think is planning to spend a significant amount of time. She will be talking about ESSA, Every Student Succeed Act, which of course is the new federal education act, which is now in effect, and regulations are being written, and the department's preparing their plans. And we'll have a good overview from the commissioner on that and chance to ask questions of her at that time. So, all right, everyone settled in. And I think, Ms. Adrians, you're kicking off. Is that correct?
I think that's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. And if you please just introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Emily Adrians. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee. And I'm going to, I think, quickly go over our tracking sheet, which is the spreadsheet. So in your packets, you should have a spreadsheet. It says on the top, it's November 2016 forecast. For those of you who have been on the committee before, you probably know that this is a very pared-down spreadsheet. This is about as simple as you'll ever see it. But I thought it was a good starting point. I just wanted to kind of get everybody back into the swing of looking at the numbers and getting familiar with the spreadsheet. So I'm not going to focus too much on the numbers, although I will say that this budget, it spends the biggest chunk out of the general fund money that the state has to spend. I think it's like 42% or something. So that amounts to almost like $9 billion per year. So you'll have some big decisions to make this year. So what you'll see in the spreadsheet, we'll have the biennium that we're currently in, the 2016-17 biennium will be in there, but the bulk of your work will be for the 2018-19 biennium, and those columns are in the middle of this spreadsheet. And then the 2020 and 21 biennium, those are what we refer to as the tails, so you will also be making decisions that will impact those years as well. In the spreadsheet, for ease of explaining where things are, I try to always have on the very left-hand side, you'll see a number next to every line, because the sheet will get pretty complicated pretty quickly. So I hope that will help, so I can just say, you know, if you look at line 28 or something like that. The areas that we cover in the spending, so the general education area is the biggest chunk of the budget. You'll see that for 2016 and 17, our general education program total is on line 30, And for the biennium, it's close to $13.6 billion. So that's another thing I should point out, that the numbers on the spreadsheets are always in thousands. I hope that doesn't confuse anybody. And then, so underneath that, we have some education excellence program areas. And so I won't go through that, but you can kind of look through the spreadsheet. And anytime you have questions about programs, I'm always happy to talk to you about it. I can also do some research and get pretty in-depth in specific program areas that you might want more information about. On the second page of the spreadsheet, you'll see there's standards and assessment, charter schools, special programs. I'm just going to keep going. On the third page, we have a facilities and technology area, nutrition programs, libraries. And so all of those areas are what we call the categoricals. And so the total for those, it's just a little bit over $3 billion for the biennium. So that, I think, is the second biggest chunk of spending in the area. After that, we have some family and early childhood programs, which you'll get to know very well. We have early childhood and family support, community support services, self-sufficiency, and lifelong learning. All of the family and early ed things are just under $400 million for the biennium. And then finally, on the last page, you'll see the state agencies that the committee has jurisdiction over. So the Department of Education and the Board of Teaching, it used to be housed under the Department of Education, but starting in fiscal year 2017, they're on their own. So that's why they get their own line item in the spreadsheet. And then we have the Minnesota State Academies. That's the State Academies for the Blind and Deaf. And then the Perpich Center for Arts Education. So on the bottom line, that's when I'm talking about the $17-plus billion, that's where you'll kind of see that grand total. The committee will have some special revenue areas. We also have shift numbers to talk about, but we'll get to all that as we move along. The spreadsheet, once the governor comes out with his recommendations, I'll update the spreadsheet to include those, and then the committee will get a target, and you'll start working towards that target. So at every step of the way, we'll likely be updating the spreadsheet with new numbers and then going over that too. So if there aren't any questions, I think that's about it.
Okay. Thank you. It was a very kind of quick overview, but, again, I think a good familiarization with kind of the general tracking sheet that we have and the format that we use. Any questions about that? All right. Seeing none.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
if I could just add, as members will progress through the year, they'll be measuring against the budget base, which is what Ms. Adrian says built into the spreadsheet in front of you. So these are essentially the starting place numbers. They're the estimate of the base for each of these programs, and any change that the committee is making is measured against the base. So, for example, if the committee increases general education aid or decreases aid for another area or whatever it does, those changes, as Ms. Adrian makes the spreadsheet longer with more columns, will be compared to base. And so that's what adds our first element of difference. When the governor's changes come out, those will be compared to base. And then you, as the House committee, when you put your changes together, those will be compared to base as well. So really what you're measuring to is not to zero, but to base. Mm-hmm. And what you have on the spreadsheet right now reflects the November 2016 forecast of base for each of those individual years.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Adrians, then as we introduce bills that cost money, then they go into the categories that are already established on the sheet, and then the addition no money just goes up, right?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, it kind of depends on how the committee wants to do the tracking, but traditionally we like to reflect change items on the spreadsheet And so, yes, then you'll see it sort of in addition to the different category totals. And then we'll be working against our target, if you will. So, yes, I think that's right.
And Madam Chair, do you keep a separate tracking sheet for bills as they're introduced? Separate from the forecast spreadsheet?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I'm told that yes, I do.
We're all due. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Ms. Adrians, can you tell me what line item is it where it was the last year's pre-K that was added, those dollar amounts, which I was just looking really quickly, and I couldn't see where that was located under.
Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt, I am going to let Tim Strom answer that question.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, this is a bit of a tricky issue as the governor's voluntary pre-kindergarten program that passed last year was part of general education and is done through additional pupil unit weighting for the four-year-old. So as a result, it shows up as part of the general education line. There may be some interest because of that in this committee of trying to separate out a tracking number for that, but essentially it's buried now in each and every school funding formula because the four-year-olds that were accepted into the program are now just in the regular pupil weighting and treated the same as all of the other 930,000 funding students in the state.
Thank you.
And Mr. Strom, just the chair's preference would be to separate that out. Is that possible?
Madam Chair, Ms. Adrians will speak to this too as well. We'll separate out essentially a dummy number for you, but it really affects everything that's on the list that's affected by pupil weighting. So, for example, if that district gets integration aid, if it's got slightly more pupils now because they have some pupils in the voluntary pre-K, there's integration aid and that kind of thing. We're not going to show an individual line item under each and every program, but Ms. Adrians and I would be glad to talk about how to display a single line item that shows the total for you, just to keep that in mind. But it's really buried throughout each and every formula that keys off the pupil weighting.
Right. Understood. Thank you.
And Madam Chair and members, if I may add, we had talked about pulling out a few of the bigger items. There's compensatory as a total in there, universal pre-K, and then I think operating referendum are some of the biggest chunks that are sort of buried in that general education number. So I think the plan moving forward is to pull a few of those out so we have a good understanding of what those are as a part of that funding.
Yes, I think that's helpful just because some of those details become important as we talk about future plans. So. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, members, we'll have other documents, including printouts that show voluntary pre-kindergarten by district and that kind of thing, where the printouts will offer you additional guidance on how those programs are working. The issue that we face on the tracking sheet, Ms. Adrian's tracking sheet, really reflects each individual appropriation that's named in the bill that's passed. And so voluntary pre-kindergarten's rolled into general education, as is the operating referendum revenue, and that's why they, and compensatory, for example, and that's why they traditionally don't have a line on the statewide tracking sheet. But it's our goal for Ms. Adrians and I to provide you information as helpful as we can. So we'll put separate lines on the tracking sheet when that's of help to you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, then, just for clarification on the forecast spreadsheet as it exists today, then the four-year-old and so forth, that's part of the 13817 or the 13907?
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Strong. Murphy, yes, that's correct. The 13,817,000,000 for general education includes about 20-some million for the voluntary four-year-old pre-kindergarten program.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay. I think we're ready to move on to the next one.
Uh,
Madam
Chair, members, in addition to this committee being responsible for the education aides, this committee is also responsible for managing the school district levy target. You'll have two levy documents in your folder. The first is a single sheet oriented portrait style that says school district levies for pay 16 sorted from largest to smallest by fund. And what this is a simplified tracking sheet for you to see. As Ms. Adrian said, on the aid side for the biennium that you're going to be dealing with, the 18-19 biennium, you've got a grand total of about $18 billion of aids. You also have about $2.6 billion of levy for the pay 16 levy, for the pay 17 levy, and then you'll be dealing with the pay 18 levy as well. The pay 17 levy just got set by school boards over December, and that data is being processed. We'll have final pay 17 levy information for you in a week or so. The payable year, the pay 17 levy goes with the 17-18 school year. So one way to keep these things straight is the payable year is the first year of the school year, and the fiscal year is the second year of the school year. So you're budgeting for the 17-18 and 18-19 school years, and that's pay 17 levy and pay 18 levy. The pay 17 levy will already be set, so you'll only be making essentially 1 year of levy decisions. The pay 18 levies that go with fiscal year 19 as you do choices this session. The purpose of this sheet is just to give you a sense of the number of levy categories that you face and also the relative funding. I've grouped them by fund. School districts have a variety of funds they use. We separate operating and non-operating funds. Non-operatings for things like buildings and that kind of thing. And you can see for pay 16, the last year, we have final data for about $2.6 billion of levy that school districts raise. And you as a committee are responsible for that levy and also will be receiving some sort of levy target, often zero, when the budgeting process begins. And your bill will need to be careful not to violate the levy target as well as any state aid targets that you get. Levies for school districts are fairly complicated. Not only do you have a whole page full of different levies, you also have two different tax bases that are used, and we'll spend some time in the PowerPoint presentation talking about those two tax bases. The main tax base is net tax capacity, or adjusted net tax capacity, we sometimes call it when the sales ratio is involved. And then a few levies, including the operating referendum levy that your districts pass, those are based on a definition called referendum market value, which is an entirely different configuration of tax base. And we'll talk a fair amount in this committee about tax base. A number of the programs that affect school property taxes also are in the tax committee as well. So you as committee members will have a fair amount of back and forth with your colleagues on the tax committee as the school levy is being set and as other school tax issues are being discussed. You can see that operating referendum on this sheet, the first line listed at about $585 million a levy, is the biggest of the general fund levies, and then you can look down the list and see that some get to be pretty darn small. These are in totals, not in thousands of dollars, so $585 million is the biggest there. And then if you look to the bottom of the page, for all the buildings that school districts build, they generally sell bonds to build those buildings and then make an annual levy to repay the bonds. That's called the debt service levy. And in the debt service fund, you can see about $847 million annually of levy for purposes of building new buildings and maintaining buildings and repaying the bonds on the buildings that have already been built. So right. Again, you'll have your aid target on the aid tracking sheet, and then you'll have a levy target as well. You'll primarily be dealing with 1 year of levy because pay 17 is essentially final now. So the first year of the 2 years of the biennium, that levy is already going to be fixed as you start your deliberations.
Right. And Representative Scott, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. What is the tree growth fund?
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Strauss. Scott, a number of the levies, particularly the smaller ones, reflect particular circumstances. And there used to be some portions of our tax system, of our property tax system, that recognized and for valuation purposes treated forest land that was cut. It was called stumpage. differently, and that essentially provided additional revenue to school districts. And when the tax committee decided to change the way that the stumpage was measured, it had a negative effect on a half dozen school districts or so. And so they were given authority to levy to replace the money that they lost through the actions of the tax committee when it changed the way that stumpage was treated. For each of our levy categories, we're happy to give you a district-by-district list of it, but there were only about half a dozen districts that were affected by that, and this was essentially replacement revenue for them for money they would otherwise be losing because of the treatment of the way forested land was handled by the tax committee.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How long ago was that instituted? Do you know the general... when that happened?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we'll double-check real quick on that. I think it was about 15 years ago, Representative Scott. We'll double-check the year on that, but I think that's been fixed at that amount for about 15 years or so.
Thank you. Other questions? And we went through this kind of quickly, but just, I mean, everyone picked up on the fact levy is basically what your local property taxpayers are paying that goes in some component back to your schools for some purpose through levy. And we are established with a levy target. Often it's zero. So that whatever we do in terms of education finance is not having an impact of raising property taxes locally. So just to be mindful that there is a fair amount of interaction between tax policy and what we do here on this committee.
And Madam Chair, for those new to the committee, one other way to think about this as well is that school districts are essentially subject to levy limits, and their only way around those is a voter-approved referendum, either for a building or operating purposes. But otherwise, there's formulas in statute for each of these levy programs that determine what the maximum levy is. So essentially, the legislature is telling school districts you've got a maximum amount of levy, and there's a whole process that's used to arrive at what those levy pages are for each district based on the formulas in statute.
Thank you. And Mr. Strom, do you cover what equalization means later in your, so we don't need to talk about that right now?
I think we'll put some separate materials together for Thursday on equalization. I think it'd be good for us to have a quick overview, and maybe we'll use either the operating or the debt levy as our example for that. There's a couple of references I should have mentioned that Ms. Adrians and I have put together for the committee. Each year we take a separate approach to updating a school finance guidebooks. And so those two guidebooks, we'll have copies for you at our next meeting. You've probably got those in your offices separate as well. But they take two different approaches to calculating each of the formulas and provide you sort of a line item way to go through each individual formula and some history on each of those. So those are sometimes good reference materials for members to have in their folders, and we can always refer back to those for detailed information on each of these school funding formulas, including those that are equalized.
Yes, thank you. Is anyone familiar with, you've seen it? They've got a green cover this year, school finance and minutes. Okay. So we'll make sure that you each have a copy in your committee packets for tomorrow in case you hadn't gotten a copy of that yet. All right. And other questions? Okay, then I think are we moving on to the PowerPoint now then?
Yes, Madam Chair, we are.
All right, very good.
We've got this on the screen for you as well.
All right, and the pages will be handing it out to the members. We weren't sure if we were going to get to it yet today or not, so.
And Madam Chair, is it your preference that Ms. Adrians and I take questions as we go through this?
Yes, I think that would be most helpful if that's all right with you.
Absolutely.
All right.
Committee members, you're just being handed out about a 50-page packet of an overview of school finance. What Ms. Adrians and I'd like to do is set a bit of a context for you. We'll talk about K-12's role in the overall state budget. We'll talk about the school property taxes in terms of the overall property tax budget. And we'll talk about a few of the concepts, including equalization, and show you some recent trends and that kind of thing. What's on the screen is the PowerPoint is also being handed out, so it may be easier for you to use the paper copy that's coming in front of you. If you have any questions, please feel free to stop and ask us. This is a presentation that we use in a number of different formats, and the department helps me put this together. Tom Melcher of the department and I use this these materials to train new school board members as well about the role of state aid and local property taxes in our school funding system. As always, in this particular version, if there's any mistakes, those are mine and not Tom's. So we'd like to talk about five real areas for you. We'd like to talk about how school funding actually works. Then we'd like to talk about the context for school funding. We'll talk about some of the major formulas and the components of our finance system. We'll look at trends and issues and how those have changed over time. And then I think it's helpful, even though you've heard this information in other committees and in other places, Ms. Adrians and I would like to just set a little context of the state budget outlook for you and what the $1.4 billion on the bottom line really means and some different ways to think about that as your committee goes about doing its work. In Minnesota, the primary lesson we try to drive home to folks is that our funding system is nearly always based on the count of students served. So our key measurement is going to be the number of pupils that are actually served by the charter school or the school district. That's the key that we use. We weight those students by grade level, and we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. But unlike some states where there's program-based funding or some other styles of funding, in Minnesota, it's nearly always based, the formulas are nearly always based on the number of students that the district is serving. So if there are fewer students because of open enrollment or fewer students because fewer kids are coming into the school district, that district is going to get less total money. If there are more students because of growing population in the district or open enrollment in, for example, that district's going to get more money because it's based on the count of students served. We use a couple of different counts when we talk about students, and we'll get into those in a bit. But when we say students served, we sometimes also use the acronym Adjusted Average Daily Membership for the unweighted version, and Adjusted Pupil Units for the weighted version. And we'll see some tables of the weighting here in a minute. One other thing to point out, even though most of our funding formulas are based on the students actually served and the responsibility of funding for those students goes with the serving district, the one area that's different is special education. And in that area, the resident district is on the hook for any unreimbursed costs. So the initial calculations for special education are all made at the student served level, but once the funding's been applied, if a school district or charter school is serving a child from another district and there's unreimbursed costs, in general, the rule is 90% of those unreimbursed costs get charged back to the resident district. But for most other purposes, the district that's the serving district is the primary district, the funded district, for school funding purposes. We want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about the legal context for school funding in Minnesota. Then we'll talk about some terminology, and then we're going to look at property taxes and the state budget. Minnesota, like many states, has some constitutional provisions directing you how school funding should work. That's the good news. The bad news is the words that are used in the Constitution are pretty wide open. And the two statements that are of our Constitution related to school funding, the first is it's the duty of the legislature, that's you, to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. Well, general and uniform aren't real well defined, and as you'll see as our committee moves through the process this year, there can be lots of arguments on both sides of those, but the Constitution nevertheless says it should be general and uniform. Then there's two other magic words in the Constitution, and those are the second statement that the legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools. So your charge is to create a school funding system that's general and uniform and thorough and efficient. We did have a court case regarding our constitutional provisions, and the Minnesota Supreme Court ultimately ruled in favor of the state and said that the system at the time in the late 80s and early 90s was constitutional. That decision did a couple of important things. It said that education is a fundamental right in Minnesota that has some ramifications that we won't get into today. But it also, in that decision, which was kind of interesting, the Supreme Court said, well, we think everyone in the plaintiff districts, those that were suing the state, were getting an adequate education. So we don't think there's a basis for the suit because they were all getting an adequate education. That's where that word adequate comes into play, whether if our system were challenged again or not, whether it would be seen to be adequate or not might be an open issue. But in 1993, the Supreme Court said the system we had at the time was certainly adequate. Minnesota statutes govern most of the laws for school districts. In large part, school districts are primarily subject to state law. Unlike some areas in the legislature where you're dealing with an area where there's a lot of federal laws, there are some federal laws, primarily in the areas of special education and food service. But most of the laws that affect our school districts are state laws. Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought my email was closed here. Sorry about that. And so most of the laws that you're going to see are in the state statutes that apply to school districts. Our funding scheme, essentially, with some small modifications, is state law. We have a separate system of special education laws in this state. We also have federal special education laws, and I should mention that the previous federal law, No Child Left Behind, was replaced recently by the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA is the acronym that goes on. That puts a number of conditions on the state, and I'm sure when the commissioner is speaking to you, she'll talk about the department's role in terms of implementing a state plan that's approved by the federal government for purposes of that act. But in general, the takeaway message is most of Minnesota school law is set by the state, not at the local level and not at the federal level. The Department of Education administers the school law for us. There's a number of items of guidance that the department provides to individual school districts that are quite helpful. The superintendent sends weekly emails to, the commissioner sends weekly emails to the superintendents and business managers updating them on all sorts of issues. School districts are subject to a variety of accounting systems for both finances and students. Those are required by state law. The accounting system that school districts use has been in place since the 70s and is referred to by the acronym UFARS. When you hear your business managers talk about that, they're talking about the state-mandated accounting system that they use that allows all the data to be treated in a comparable manner. The MARS system is the system for pupil accounting. Most of this is of the routine variety, but as Representative Scott knows, there are a number of issues when we talk about counting pupils, particularly young ones, that have to do with privacy of student information and that kind of thing. So sometimes the world of data privacy will be involved when we talk about how we are counting our students. And finally, there's also a staff accounting system and a serves accounting system that the department uses. But essentially, through all those different tools, the department provides a lot of guidance and a lot of interpretation of state law and federal law to school districts about how they should be interpreting various provisions. There are a number of federal regulations that I'm not going to spend too much time on today. As I said, most of those are in the area of special education, Title I, or food service. A couple of terminology issues for you. Good news on the school side. Unlike other local units of government, the school fiscal year is the same as the state. So July 1st through June 30th is the school's fiscal year. That's the same as the state fiscal year, and that's kind of helpful when we're lining up finances. The federal government, of course, has a different fiscal year. The federal fiscal year runs October 1st through September 30th. And in years with continuing resolutions and other things, the federal funds can be uncertain for quite a bit of time after the school year starts. But the takeaway, schools, unlike counties and cities, are on the same fiscal year as the state. As I mentioned earlier, most of our funding is based on the pupils. So how we define pupils in the state, how we count them, and how we weight them are exceedingly important. We tend to refer to our student count as average daily membership. Unlike some states, we don't count the kids just once on October 1st or some other day. We take essentially an FTE count, how long is the student in that school during the school year, and that's referred to average daily membership is the term we use for that. The student counts as one student in average daily membership if they're going full-time, with the exception now of the new voluntary pre-kindergarten students where they're limited to not more than 0.6 of a student count for purposes of their average daily membership. We also have something that replaced summer school funding back in the mid-80s was when this change was made, and the term we use for the funding for extended time, extended year programs is called extended time average daily membership. And so many of your school districts will be offering a program in the summer or later in the day throughout the school year where they can generate additional pupil weights under the extended time program. We then take those pupil counts, that FTE count, and we weight by grade level. And this grade level, luckily, has been simplified a fair amount from where it was a few years ago. Really, the main differential is kids in grades 7 through 12 are counted 20% more. They're weighted at 1.2. So if you have 100 kids in your school and you're an all-elementary charter school, for example, you would have 100 weighted pupil units, and if you had 100 children in your school and they were all secondary students, they would count as 120 pupil units. So keep in mind that even though we count the pupils the same as on their FTE basis, we do weight the secondary kids at 20% more. There's a small flag here that the kindergarten program, as many of you know, we went to full-day kindergarten funding about 4 years ago. The kindergarten weight used to be 0.55 for the half-day program. There's still that option, but my understanding is there's only one, as of last year, there was only one school in the state that was offering anything other than full-time kindergarten. So pretty much every district now has just full-time kindergarten, and those students count as 1.0. So we get this pupil units number that we sometimes refer to as adjusted weighted average daily membership or adjusted pupil units, and that's the basis for funding for nearly all our school finance formulas. Skip a couple of pages here. I want to talk a little about property tax now, and we'll go over this a couple more times, and certainly when some bills on these matters come up. In Minnesota, we have two tax bases that school districts use. There's the referendum market value and adjusted net tax capacity. And let me just make a brief couple of statements about these, and as I say, we'll come back to these a bit. For operating referendums, the voter-approved additional money for the school district, not the bond issues, but for additional spending, those are calculated and spread against referendum market value. And referendum market value is really the estimated market value of the district, excluding two classes of property. Estimated market value is really just the assessed value of each piece of property in the state. So you add up the value of each house and each business and each piece of farmland and each cabin, and that gives estimated market value. For a variety of reasons, in the late 90s, this definition of referendum market value was created, and it excludes two classes of property, ag lands and seasonal rec, or the cabins. And what that means is when your voters approve a referendum for additional operating purposes, that is spread against a tax base that doesn't include ag land and it doesn't include cabins. That's a different tax base than what you'll use for most of the other formulas. And it also, because there's no class rates involved in referendum market value, means that a dollar of business property is taxed the same as a dollar of home property, which isn't the case when we get to tax capacity. We have four or five now school levies that are against referendum market value. It's about $900 million out of the $2.6 billion, with the biggest one being the operating referendum. The rest of those levies, the other 25 or so levies, are spread against, are calculated and spread on net tax capacity. And what net tax capacity is, it's the taxable market value for all types of property in the state. But then it's assigned the class rates that the tax committee has put in place for each type of property. And those class rates, we've got a table that'll show up here in a second. Those class rates differ by property type, and those are legislatively determined. Those aren't an accident that they've happened that way, but there's a lot of controversy around those class rates. And any change that the tax committee makes to those class rates will affect how the distribution of each school levy is felt by that community. The final part of our definition of tax base, we take net tax capacity and we divide it by something called the sales ratio. Luckily, the discussions about the sales ratio have been pretty quiet the last few years. Essentially, the sales ratio, what it does is it keeps the system from a practical point of view on the same level with the assumption that there could be differing assessment practices throughout the state. What it does is it compares the actual sales price of each property to the assessed value of that property and makes an adjustment to the tax base if there's a difference. In years when there's not too much difference, that sales ratio is pretty close to one. In a few years, we've had some very big differences in a few communities, and there's been some discussion about how the sales ratio actually works. But essentially what it is a tool that levels out assessment differences that have occurred when there's a difference between the sales price and the assessed value of a piece of property. We have a third tax base that I hesitate to mention, but it probably will be considered in some additional ways this year. It's not a tax base to spread levies, but to calculate the equalization share, which we'll talk about tomorrow, on the long-term facilities maintenance revenue formula. We use a tax base that's ANTC, adjusted net tax capacity, but excluding half of the ag land. So the idea there is to give a reduction in the amount of tax that would otherwise be paid by that community because of its presence of ag land. And you're going to hear a lot about ag land tax this session. There's some provisions in the ag bill that did not, or in the tax bill that did not pass last year that had to do with school bonds and agricultural taxes that were paid by those farmlands on the school taxes. I'm guessing that this concept of a tax base that reflects half the ag land is going to come up a number of times this session. When you look at those class rates, the residential homestead property tax class rate is 1% on the first $500,000 of value. So if you have a home that's worth $200,000, the 1% class rate would be applied to that, and the portion of net tax capacity that would make would be $2,000. But you can see there's some differing class rates for other types of property. The most important two differences to point out is that the first $2.1 million of ag land have a lower class rate at basically half that rate of the residential homes. And then commercial industrial, which is the business properties, have a class rate that's double the homestead class rate for that portion of the value over $150,000. So a lot of the discussion the tax committee has is how those class rates are set and whether they're in the right place. And for you in the education committee, the concern will be how that will affect the distribution of various levies amongst the school districts if those class rates are changed. We talked about that sales ratio a little bit. As I said, in the last couple of years, that's been less of an issue as the sales ratios have been pretty close to one in most districts. So what that gives us then are two measures that we can look at. If you look at the page 15, there's two pie charts here that talk about the total market value versus the taxes paid. And you can see that on the left is the total market value. In residential homesteads, the houses make up 47% by value, not quite half of that $642 billion. Commercial industrial property only makes up 14% of the total, while ag lands make up 23% of the total. And then as you go to the right and look at the taxes actually paid, you can see that due to deliberate decisions that have been made at the legislature and have been enacted statutorily, homesteads get a bit of a break. They actually pay 41% of the taxes in the state, whereas ag land pays only 9% compared to the 23% of market value. Commercial industrial pays 35% compared to its 14% of taxable market value. And the seasonal rec, the cabins, and the other residential, which is mainly apartment buildings, are at roughly the same shares. So again, what that means, these may be decisions that folks are happy with. They may be unhappy with them for one reason or another, but important to think of them as ratios. Anything that happens to make that ag share lower, for example, if the tax is actually paid, unless that's done through a credit on the tax base, essentially what that's going to mean is a greater share is going to be picked up by those other types of property. Same with the commercial industrial, the business taxes. If one makes a decision that those should be higher or lower, the relative share of its size of the pie will change compared to the other four shares of the pie. Seems like we're spending a lot of time on tax base, but it's really going to be, I think, a crucial issue this session. And the more that members have a good understanding of of tax base and the relative shares of things, the easier it's going to go as equalization formulas are examined. When we look at where those taxes go, about $9.2 billion overall of property tax, and you can see that school districts are, even though they're only about a quarter of school district funding, school districts receive 28% of the total property taxes. Counties receive the largest share, about 31%. Cities receive 23%. There's about 2.5% off the tax rolls into TIF districts as far as the local governments are concerned, 4% in special taxing jurisdictions, and about 9% of the state property tax that's paid is paid by commercial, industrial, and a little bit by seasonal rec property in through the statewide property tax. And that 9% that's paid through the statewide property tax is in part why, when you go back to the previous chart, that the commercial industrial property tax pays about 35% of the total property tax in the state. When we look at specific levy changes over time, the blue line here shows what's happened to school levies over time. The red line is other local governments other than schools, the cities and counties, townships. And you can see how property tax have changed over time. There's a big point of discontinuation in this. In 2001, the legislature and Governor Ventura agreed to reduce school property taxes by about $1 billion, from $1,922,000,000 to $984 million, from $1.9 billion to $984 million. And you can see there was a great big drop that year in school property taxes, but every year since now, the property taxes have been growing a bit. You can see the rate of the growth compared to other local units of government and school districts over time. We're going to talk more about levies by type when we talk about equalization, but you can see some of the trends here with the various school levies over time. And again, we'll talk more about this when we talk about equalization. I think it's really helpful for this committee to have a bit of an understanding of the role of property tax in terms of our overall system of funding state and local government in Minnesota. Often this committee will hear about things when the Minnesota Miracle came into place and why can't things be like that, or were they ever like that when that happened. And what this chart tries to do is show the history of major taxes as a percentage over time. And that top line, the bluish line there, shows property taxes were indeed more than half of the total state and local government revenue back in the 50s. And even though they decreased a fair amount during the 1960s, by the time of the Minnesota Miracle in 1971, they were still 42% of the total taxes that were used by state and local government. And you can see that they've essentially declined for most years since then, with some increases starting after 2001 and then some dropping after that, crested in 2007. You can see the other major sources of taxes on here as well. That's of less interest to this committee than to the overall tax committee, since most of the funding that will come for this committee will come straight out of the general fund, as it's not linked to any particular tax, like the sales tax or the income tax or gambling tax or anything like that. Nearly all of the K-12 funds that Ms. Adrian's talked about that are state aid come out of the state general fund. And when we talk about the state general fund, let's see here what happened. Advance to the next slide here. There we go. When we talk about the state general fund, the labels got a little scrambled here. I apologize for that. The state general fund's got about $24.3 billion in it in the current year. You can see about 46% of that's from the income and 23% from the sales tax. Again, not too important that you know where those other taxes are for your purposes, since you're going to be spending out of the general fund, but just to give you a bit of context there. Where that money's going, as Ms. Adrian's mentioned, 42% of all that state general fund money is spent by this committee as part of the K-12 budget. So 42% of the general fund money, of that $21.3 billion of general fund money, is being spent on K-12 schools. You can see, or pre-K through K-12 schools. You can see the other portions of the pie there. Human services, about 29%, and around public safety, criminal justice, 5%. Intergovernmental aids, which are mainly property tax aids for cities and counties. There's a small share of that for school districts as well. So a portion of that 8% is for school districts. And then the state government, about 4% of the total, and support for the state's higher ed institutions through the higher ed committee is about 7% of the total. But the main takeaway here for you should be about 42% of all that general fund money is being spent by this committee. As I mentioned earlier, and Madam Chair, we want to wrap up right at 2:30, is that right, or 2:45? 2:45, thank you. As I mentioned earlier, our system in Minnesota is one that funds on the basis of pupils, and so the overall number of pupils in the system is hugely important to determining how much it's going to cost to fund the system. What this chart on page 22 shows is school enrollment trends since 1960. And you can see that those baby boom years from 1960 to 1972 were really something. 250,000 students added to the system in just a little over a 10-year time period. Starting in the mid-1970s, there was a pretty substantial decrease in the number of pupils as we got onto the other side of the baby boom, and that number went back down to just under 700,000 pupils in 1984. And since that time, now you can see on the public school line, on the top line there, that those number of pupils have increased pretty substantially. And then when you get to 1991 on this graph, it's hard to see for the first few years, but the dotted line at the top here is the number of charter school students, the difference between that and the dark blue school district line. And you can see now as you come all the way over to about 2015, where we have 851,000 students in the public school system in Minnesota, about 50,000 of those are charter school students, 801,000 are served by the districts. As Representative Wills mentioned, we have a number of homeschoolers in Minnesota. The bottom line shows that there's about 18,700 homeschoolers reporting as of 2016. The data for homeschoolers was not collected in years prior to 1987, and even though there was substantial growth in the number of reported homeschoolers, there's some suggestion that there was a fair amount of underreporting in the first few years. So if one looks at the increase in homeschoolers in Minnesota from 1987 to about 1995, much of that is presumed to be underreporting. But you can see there's been slow but steady growth in the number of homeschoolers since that time. And then the last line on this chart shows the number of students enrolled in traditional non-public student schools in Minnesota. And you can see that crested during about 6 years prior to the baby boom crest at about 158,000 non-public schools, and dropped pretty substantially pretty quickly, fell under 100,000 students back in the late 70s, and has continued a pretty slow but continuous decline since then. And now, as of the end of 2016, we have about 66,000 traditional non-public students in Minnesota. In terms of our funding formulas, as I mentioned earlier, we often use this term resident pupil unit. When we use that term, we're counting students in the resident district that attend public school of one sort or another. That count of resident pupils in Minnesota, when we talk about it in this committee, does not include the non-public or the homeschool pupils. If we break down
Mr. Strong, yes. Please suspend. Representative Moran has a
question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just give me an idea of what is a non-public pupil?
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, in Minnesota, for the non-public schools, the largest single group is the sectarian schools, like the Catholic schools. There's a number of non-religious, non-public schools. There are a much smaller number in Minnesota. And then one of the interesting features of Minnesota law is it doesn't make a real clear divide between homeschool and non-public school in some ways. So sometimes when we talk about traditional non-public, we're talking about a thing that would look like a real school with a independent building and that kind of thing, and that's accredited. But often a homeschool can serve more than just members of an individual's family, and so for that reason, the line between non-public and traditional non-public and homeschool in Minnesota is a little blurred in some contexts. So some things that we would think of as a traditional non-public school might actually be more like a homeschool in some other people's classification of it. But we have some special reporting requirements for certain homeschools, and then some exclusions for homeschools under a certain size of that. But unlike some states where they have a very clear distinction in the non-public world between homeschool and non-public, we don't have that clean distinction in exactly the same way in Minnesota.
Representative Moran?
Madam Chair, members, if we look at the changes in school enrollment by some different groups here, there's four lines on this chart. The top line shows the change in the number of students eligible for free and reduced lunch statewide. This is our measure of students from low-income families that we tend to use in the K-12 world, in part because the free and reduced lunch data is gathered every year at each school site. So it's a really good income marker for the state to use to examine things. Free and reduced price meals are the proxy variable that's used in our compensatory revenue formula, and we'll talk about that formula a fair amount this session. About $550 million a year is allocated through the compensatory revenue formula. And you can see statewide that the number of students eligible for free and reduced lunch has grown from about 27% in 2003 to more than 38% in the current year. The years, just the last couple of years, have shown relatively flat growth. But prior to that, statewide, the increase had been at about 1% per year, or roughly a little under 1% per year for most of the years statewide. There's, of course, communities where that growth is very different than the state average, but for the state average, you can see a pretty significant climb up until about 2014, where it's leveled off. The long-term projections are for that increase to continue at a slower rate for years past 2016.
I think Representative Dabney had a question.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, we, I think, always lump together free and reduced price lunch. And I know there's been some recent research that has looked at the differences in those two groupings and tends to find that those families that qualify for free lunch often are families that experience chronic multi-generational poverty, while many families after a divorce, after a layoff, something like that, may temporarily experience qualification for reduced price lunch. Do we have data that would allow us to differentiate and actually look at what percentage of Minnesota students and families are in that more persistent poverty versus the reduced price lunch families and the growth trends over time in those areas?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, yes, we collect, since 1996, we've collected free status, reduced status, and then others. So we have those two categories. The free status, they use the same guidelines that are established for the free lunch, and I believe that's 130% of the federal poverty rate, and it's scaled by family size. So the larger the family, the higher that federal poverty for the family is. And so that the free is set at 130% of that, and the reduced at 185% of that. And we have, the state has collected the data separately for free and reduced priced meals, and that data we can sure get you back as far as you want, up back toward 1996 to see the changes in those two categories. We don't have any differential within those categories. So we only know free or not free, reduced or not reduced for the categories. We that information is collected since the late 90s. It's been collected at the school site level. And so sometimes continuations and sites are created and closed. But generally speaking, that's pretty consistent data over time. And I would just add that our compensatory revenue formula, the way that formula works, the free students count as 1, and the reduced price students under that formula count as 0.5. So there is, in the current formula, a scaling where the reduced price students count half as much as a free for purposes of the initial weighting determination.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, I'd be interested in seeing that data for some reasonable period of time, 10 years or something.
Yeah, Madam
Thank
Chair,
you.
We'd be glad to provide that. Madam Chair, one, and maybe you'd like to comment on the policy you'd prefer for this. In some past years, when a member has asked for a data item, we'll provide that to the member and to the chair, and at your discretion, you can include that in the folders or not. It's entirely how you'd like to do that.
Yes, I think unless dictated otherwise, just provide it to the full committee.
Okay, I'd be glad to do that, Madam Chair. Three other subpopulation groups, if you will, to show some changes over time. The second line on this graph shows the change in the percent students of color statewide, and you can see that's grown pretty substantially from 18.9% in 2003 to 30% statewide. That change has been pretty much uniform over time, but not by community so much. Some communities have seen very large changes, while other communities have seen small changes or even changes the other direction over time. So you can see again that the state has gone from about 19 to about 30% children of color in the public school system. The third line on here shows the count and percent of special education students. We use a count called the unduplicated child count, and you can see this count has increased a bit over time from 13.2 to 15%, but this count is less helpful often than a cursory glance would allow, in large part because the categories, each of the categories of special education services may be changing at a different rate, and you may be adding some in a category that tends to be a relatively expensive disability category or not. So you can see some small growth there in terms of the number of percentage of special ed students, but that's essentially masking an increase of cost for special ed students that's quite a bit greater than that because of the changing classes of special education. Then the last individual data line to highlight is the English learner line, and you can see that the state as a whole has gone from about 6% students whose first language is other than English and are in English learning programs beginning in 2003 up to about 8% to 2016. But that, what looks like relatively stable change statewide, is very different on a community-by-community basis, including in greater Minnesota, depending on the, sorry about this. Oh, you can't see the emails that are coming in. Oh, that's good. I did not get those.
Unless you want to share them with us, yes, Mr. Strom, it is your secret.
Madam Chair, this one was from your former committee administrator. you can see that the number of English learners has increased only slightly from 6 to 8% statewide, but that really is a very different picture on an individual community basis. Some of the communities in greater Minnesota have experienced very large increases in the number of students for whom English is not a first language. And so, again, this is an area where we have some data on a district basis that we'd be glad to share with you, but the effects on the school districts and the changes that have affected some of those school districts are not as even as this line would suggest. Madam Chair, a couple of other charts for you on enrollment that are probably helpful. This committee will be looking at a whole variety of school funding formulas, in large part because Minnesota as a state is not very monolithic. If you divide the state into the economic development regions, starting in about 2001, more than half of the students now reside in the 7-county metropolitan area. That wasn't the case ever before up until 2001. Prior to that time, the other 80 counties all had combined had more students than the metropolitan area. And you can see the relative shares in each of those economic development regions in the state as you go around the pie. Perhaps somewhat surprisingly, if you look at a 5-year change in enrollment over time by region, pretty close to even in most parts of the state, with just two parts, the Northwest and the North Central regions, showing very small declines in enrollment, or in the Northeast, I'm sorry, as well, and then relatively small increases in enrollment in most of the rest of the region of the state. These trends are likely to continue at a relatively slow rate out into the future when we look at the overall enrollment growth. We see generally slow growth in most of the for statewide, and with most parts of the state holding relatively the same or just a little bit in decline on a average basis by economic development region. Now, that's not the case for the individual districts, particularly in greater Minnesota. Some of the individual districts that are quite small are seeing a fairly big distinction between the number of 12th graders graduating and the number of kindergarten students entering the school system. As I mentioned, the districts aren't all that alike, and one way to think about that is if you divide the school districts into five equal chunks of districts or quintiles, on this chart you can see that the 66 largest districts in the state serve fully 70% of the kids, while the 67 smallest districts in the state serve only about 2% of the kids in the state. Each of those small districts, many of you represent those small districts, has a board, and often those small districts will be different than the large districts, and the large districts different than the small, and a lot of times you'll see formulas that will reflect that we've got this kind of distribution among school size by our school districts. So, Madam Chair, that's sort of a wrap-up of the pupil change over time. And now, Ms. Adrians and I would like to talk a little about our school funding system. First, we'll look at a couple of revenue graphs, and then we'll talk about the general education component. And we've got a separate printout on that, and maybe we'll talk about the overall revenue components here, and then stop as the printout will take us into a separate piece of paper as well.
Well, I was thinking actually this might be a good place to make a break.
Even better.
But just because then tomorrow we can get into the meat of these components of school finance and that. So this is a lot to absorb for members if it's your first time at this. So we do have a couple of minutes if anyone has just any general questions or anything over what we covered or any questions at all while we've got our experts up here at the panel. I think. All right. If not, then everybody gets out 5 minutes early today. But we will see you back here tomorrow, and we will resume with the presentation with the components of school finance. And I don't know, Mr. Strom, if you'll have that information that Representative Davney referenced tomorrow or later, but we'll get it to everyone and make sure that it's in your packets and let you know when it's there. Yes, you can leave your information in your folders. We'll make sure we'll just leave everything in the folders because we're going to resume with this presentation tomorrow. All right, any other questions? All right, if not, thank you all. Again, welcome. So glad to have you. And committee is adjourned.